Thanks, Paul. Hi, my name is Eden Lovejoy. I am an alcoholic. In the tradition of my home group, I'll share my sobriety date, February 15th of 1994, which helps me get settled. I have to tell you, it's a pet peeve of mine to travel from Alaska to beautiful, warm places and freeze in air conditioning. Hopefully it'll warm up. I'll warm up. This topic, someone said to me yesterday, boy, you could go anywhere with that. I'm like, yeah, almost, yeah. But what I can tell you is, as I've been thinking about the great reality within us, what that has felt like to me is something that's such a personal, precious journey that, folks tell me a lot, my compliment is, you're so articulate. And around my relationship with my higher power, that's an area where I always have felt like I can't fully describe the experience of the grace of a relationship with a higher power that has evolved for me in sobriety. So to have this topic is a challenge. And we'll see where we get. I guess I'll qualify first. I'm an alcoholic. I come by it honestly. My father tells me I'm a fifth-generation drunk. I was born. What that looked like for me, the disease of alcoholism for me, presents itself as abject terror. And that's what I was born with. I know this. I have evidence. They diagnosed me with night terrors when I was an infant and put me on phenobarbital, which probably worked, but I was allergic to it. So I like to say that's the story of my life, right? I need something, and I'm allergic to my solution. So they took away the phenobarb and left me with me. And I just, I spent the first 12 years of my life absolutely terrified, uncomfortable, afraid, and alone. I was the kid on the playground who, I wore bifocals. They called me dictionary. I tried to be good enough to somehow not have you notice me. And I was the kid always over reading a book in the corner off the playground when everybody else was playing and having fun. I once told my daughter when she was in her teens that I never knew how to play. And she just said, "Oh, Mom, that's so sad." And it was, it wasn't fun. But through a series of events, my mom took off on this journey in the 70s that was this, that I had huge and deep resentments about for years and years and years. And that today I understand was a phenomenal opportunity to be exposed to so much richness. My mom was looking for the answer in San Francisco in the 70s. And, my litany is I've been Catholic, Quaker, Christian, Zen, Mormon, Buddhist, shamans, Aquarians. I took Est three times before I was 16, if you're old school. So we did a lot of stuff. I went to 15 schools and 18 homes, or 18 schools and 15 homes or something. Three different high schools, a Quaker boarding school, a ballet academy, and I graduated with a class of 21 from an integral thinking academy thing. So, but when early on in that adventure, we all changed our names. So my first name was Denise, my given name. And when I was 12, I got to pick what I was going to be. And I changed my name, started using my middle name, Eden. And at that time, like, everything was torn away from our lives. And, in retrospect, when you see sort of cult things, there's this idea that you just strip away all of the construct that someone has in their lives. And what cults do is then they implant a whole new story in the life, the story that they want you to have. Well, the cool thing about what I got to go through was they stripped everything away and then said, "Go make up what you like." Okay. So at that time, I was 12 years old. I went on a trip to Mexico. The school I was at then traveled for educational purposes. So we went to Mexico for a month. And on that trip, I got to smoke my first cigarette and take my first drink. And at the age of 12, I was a pack-a-day smoker and a blackout drunk. And you know what? I don't know what my first drink was, but I know that it was something you could get on a beach in Mexico when you were 12. I know that I drank to blackout and puking, and I came to the next morning, and everybody around me was concerned. I was this tiny little itty-bitty, you know, 12 isn't really very big. And they were concerned, and I was like, when do we go again? I'm ready. Like, let's go. You know, I used to have two passport pictures 6 months apart, and the first one was that depressed, hair straight down, dark glasses, dark sweater, sullen face, black and white picture, and that was Denise. And then I had 6 months later a picture, because I'd lost my passport and got it replaced, and the one 6 months later was the glasses are gone, the hair's blown back off the face, it's color, I have a peach scarf around my neck, this is Eden, and I have found my solution. And, you know, and I was just, let's rock. So I drank. And I drank selfishly, and I drank with unapologetically. I really don't care what you think about the way I'm behaving when I'm drinking. I'm just gonna do what I'm gonna do, what feels good, and that's, you know, I just drank. I made every decision in my life from that moment forward around getting a drink, because I took a drink and discovered that I am thirsty, and I'm big time thirsty, and I need something, I need more. You know, by the time I was 24, I couldn't remember the last time I'd gone 24 hours without a drink or a drug. And the first time I got sober, I've gotten sober twice, both times in Alcoholics Anonymous, and both times helped by someone outside of our program, our fellowship, who understood something about Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I was 24, someone referred me to my doctor, and he helped me detox. Put me on Anabuse, which I drank on, and he sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I understand today about that is that I was trying to stay half a step ahead at that time of consequences, right? When I got sober the first time, my life had become unmanageable, and I was trying to manage it. And so I came in, and I worked some steps, and I got a sponsor, and she worked me through some steps. And, you know, I had some huge resentments about some of that cult-like behavior, that stuff. That some of that stuff was ugly. You know, I could tell you a story today and say, hey, this is the stuff I lived through. And those things aren't pretty. But what I know is that for me, the steps have been effective every time I've worked them. And that sponsor worked me through some steps that relieved every resentment I had about that time in my life. And it's never returned. It was amazing freedom. So, of course, I got a resentment at her, and I left. Because I was 24. And, you know, and alcoholism for me, you know, is insanity, right? It says cunning, baffling, and powerful. But really, for me, it's warped, disturbed, and, you know, just wrong. I went to a noon meeting 3 days in a row, and my sponsor was there on day two and day three, and she said, it's so good to see you here 2 days in a row. Well, apparently I hadn't been going to very many meetings, and in my internal dialogue was, you know, 2 days in a row, I've been here three, and where were you? And how dare you take, you know, how dare you take that tone with me? And, you know, I have been all these religions and all these worldviews and all these different things. I know there's more than one way to do things, so don't get arrogant with me. I'll be fine. I'm out. Of course, I had no courage, no honesty, no integrity at all, so I probably just said, I'm glad to see you too. And then I went home and I didn't come back. And, you know, what I know today is that there was a woman who took time out of her life to invite me into her home to work steps with me. And what she said to me was, I'm glad to see you. And my disease said, screw you. It will set me apart from you every time. You know, when I was 24, I could maybe stay half a step ahead of my drinking by working really hard, really fast, and a lot. So I was busy for about 2 years, really super busy. And then I got drunk. Well, first I just had a glass of wine because that would be nice and civilized and adult. And, you know, now I know how not to drink. And I had a drink, and then the next week I drank again. And within a month I was drinking the way that I drink. And I am I'm a maintenance alcoholic. I'm a 24-hour-a-day, 7 days a week maintenance drunk. I shake awake at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I can't get through the night without a drink. I, you know, I'm bloated and puking and holding hostages in my house, and there's nobody invited into my life, and the phone's turned off and the blinds are drawn, and if it's sunny out, that's a drag because I don't want to have to face the fact that I can't stand to see the light of day. And the second non-alcoholic who 12-stepped me into Alcoholics Anonymous was my boss. She pulled me out of the office, and she said, on my last day drinking, she pulled me out of the office, and she said, 90 meetings in 90 days or you're fired. And yeah. She had been dating a chronic relapser for some time, and she had... I got to thank him. You know, it's interesting, that doctor who helped me into the rooms the first time, when I had that conversation with him, he said... What he said to me was, please know that we will only have this conversation once. This is all that I can offer you around your drinking. This go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my boss said, similarly, she said, you know, I know that this is painful and difficult and hard for you. I really want you to know it's not for me. And I got it. Right? This was my opportunity. This was, you know, if I did this thing, if I went to these 90 meetings in 90 days and got signatures, I could keep my job. And it was up to me to make that decision. I did not think when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I could get sober here. I did think I could keep my job. And that was enough to get me into the rooms that next day. Just a little bit, the rest of that afternoon, however, I did not go from my boss home to sobriety. I went from my boss. She followed me home, so I got there safely. My neighbor took me to a meeting. I was drunk. I was still drinking. You know, I was still drinking all day. And I shared in that meeting for a while. My sponsor says her favorite part of my story is the fact that I lost my pantyhose in that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is, you know, interesting. They asked me to stop sharing because, like, it was Valentine's Day. They were hoping for romance and love and relationships, and they got me. And So I stormed out of there. I left my coat behind. I was missing my nylons in a skirt on a February night in Anchorage, Alaska. It was dark and it was cold, and I was wandering around drunk and violent in public. And I made my way home, and I was drunk and violent in my home. And my husband had sent my children to the neighbors because he didn't think they were safe in our house. And I was furious with him. He had done the unforgivable. He had called my mother, who I still had resented all of this time. Like, how could you call that woman? And he was at his wit's end. What do you do with this mess? And I was in a rage, and I put my fist through all the pictures on the wall, and my last image of that night was slamming a butcher knife through the stainless steel of the kitchen sink. And then I blacked out, and I came to the next day, and I knew. I had come to that place in the Big Book that says eventually he will come to a place where he can no longer imagine a life with alcohol or without it. And I was there. And it goes on to say, and I'm, of course, paraphrasing, that, you know, coming to that place, we will experience a loneliness such as few people ever know. That place, that despair, that darkness, I hope I never forget. I made it to a meeting that night, shaken and chain smoking. Thank God you could smoke then. And, you know, I just came, and I didn't come with hope. I didn't come into Alcoholics Anonymous with hope. I came in desperate. and I'm grateful for that. And I came in knowing that I could keep my job. But within 3 days, I came in with ego and arrogance and opinion. And, you know, I've been all of these religious things and exposed to all of these philosophies and worldviews. And the conclusion that I came to was that, you know, that God or spirituality or religion was a crutch for people who couldn't figure out how to do their lives. And I didn't need any part of that. Now, I couldn't do my life, but I didn't need any part of that. I fought my way through the steps. Coming through the steps for me was, all about little tiny incremental fights with my arrogance and my ego. And my sponsor, bless her heart, was patient with me, and she was kind. I shouldn't say P words. Sorry. I got the first step. I had that peace. And the second step came to believe that a power greater than ourselves, thank you, could restore us to sanity. First I would argue with you that I wasn't insane because I thought I was pretty smart. And the second, I just had this huge, huge, huge resistance to the idea of any kind of God. And finally, my sponsor said, you know, Eden, I don't know if there is or there isn't a God. I'm willing to concede I'm not it. Like, well, okay. I could concede that, maybe. You know, just tiny little pieces. My sponsor asked me to pray. She asked me to kneel and pray. And I couldn't. I physically, went into a closed, room, locked the door, turned off the lights so nobody would see, and could not bring myself to my knees. My ego was so strong that my body fought the concept of kneeling in prayer to anything that I did or did not understand. And I called her and I said, I can't. She asked me if I did the Lord's Prayer at the end of my meetings, and I said yes, because I wouldn't want you to notice I was doing something different, right? And I'm going to do what you're doing. And she asked me if I could just bend my knees a tiny bit during that prayer. And that's where I started. I could do that. And, the great gift for me in Alcoholics Anonymous, that the profound miracle for me in Alcoholics Anonymous is the promise of the 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So I did the steps. And, I spent a lot of years in sobriety. See, I was confused for a really long time. I spent a lot of years in sobriety trying to put the outside of my life together. And I thought for so long that the outside of my life was what was the problem. And if I put the outsides together, that somehow I would get to be okay inside. I did the first steps. For the first 8 years of my sobriety, I only ever did steps 1 through 9 because I'm a project kind of a girl, and then I'm going to get busy about doing what I'm doing. And so for 8 years, I spent on a roller coaster of insanity in sobriety where I would, work some steps and get some relief. And then I get busy managing and controlling and directing my life, and then I get crazy, and I get homicidal. I'd rather be homicidal than suicidal, thank you. And, end up walking into a meeting telling people, if this is sobriety, I don't need any part of it. Don't touch me. Don't talk to me. I'll kill you. I mean, I just hostile. And then I would work the steps one more time and get some relief and over and over and over again. So this journey of seeking humility, of seeking a relationship with a higher power, has been a slow one for me. At 8 years of sobriety, I knew if something didn't change, I wasn't going to be able to stay. And through a series of events, a phenomenal event. My son, my beautiful son, is a truth teller in my life. We had this adventure where we, this morning, where I was trying to manipulate, facilitate, coerce, cajole, or, just drive him into an action that I wanted him to do. And then he finally said yes, and he's walking out the door, and to make myself feel better, I said, really, you don't have to do that if you don't want to. And he was, I don't know, he was 12 years old maybe, and he stopped, and he looked at me at the door. He said, "No, Mom, really, you're making me." And I saw in his face, and I got it. That's what my control does. It takes another human being who's excited about his day and forces him to my will to have that look in his eyes. And I got it. And I hit my knees that day and said, please help. I got a new sponsor and I got a new home group and I changed up what I was doing. And I got actively seeking and living the growth steps of 10, 11, and 12. And through this journey and this adventure in recovery, what I have, what has happened for me is that I have little by slowly cleared away those pieces, that ego, that self that blocks me from the great reality within, which I do experience today and at times experience the way Bill described it as that great clean wind flowing through and that light and that energy and that grace and that love that's looking in the eyes of other human beings and letting them be who they are and loving them where they are and letting myself be who I am and discovering who that is as I was created to be. And what a phenomenal adventure. I never would have found it if I hadn't been beaten by alcohol into a place of some kind of desperation where I would ask for help and hope. I've shared for years, and I'll close with this thought, that Alcoholics Anonymous brought me into relationship with God, which has allowed me to be in relationship with you. I never knew that was what I wanted when I was so isolated and separate from. And I know it's everything that I want and dream and hope for today. Thank you for my sobriety.
Thank you very much, Eden. There's still a cell phone up here somebody dropped. It's got a little black case around it, so if this is yours, it's right up front here. On page 47 in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, "When, therefore, we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. At the start, this was all we needed to commence spiritual growth. To effect our first conscious relation with God as we understood Him, afterward we found ourselves accepting many things which then seemed entirely out of reach. That was growth, but if we wish to grow, we had to begin somewhere. So we used our own conception, however limited it was." Our next speaker is Leon from Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah, I need a hug. Good morning. My name is Leon, and I am an alcoholic. I'm from Brooklyn, if you don't know. First things first, I'd like to welcome anybody new, anybody coming back, and I always like to give a special honor to the old-timers who kept these doors open so we could get this message of hope, and give a special honor to Dr. Bob and Bill so we all could be here together in sobriety. I'm nervous. It's easy saying that sitting over there. The great reality within us. The reality for me that I must face now is turning fear into faith. You know, when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, my sobriety date is June 29th, 1988. When I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, three detoxes, I found out how intelligent I was because they would ask questions. When you get interviewed for detox, And I know on my second, my third detox, the counselor had asked me, had I ever been hospitalized? And being the intelligent person, I said, no. And then she said, well, where is detox? In the hospital, you know. And then the next step was going into a rehab. And then I remember another counselor asking me, you ever been in a psychiatric ward? And, you know, with my arrogant self, no, ain't no way. She said, well, what rehab did you go? I went to Creemore. Creemore is a psychiatric facility. So when I got in contact with how it works, I knew they wrote how it works for me. When they talk about those who are mentally incapable of being honest with themselves, you know, I didn't know how to be honest, you know, what it was like, what happened and what it's like now. What happened is I found alcohol. I fell in love with alcohol. Back in the 60s, I see a lot of y'all in here know about the 60s. When they didn't have DJs and my family would have parties after work, they would put the children in the back and they would get the big disc, put it in the middle and put on like 60 45s, right? And the first hour they would be dancing and drinking. The second hour they'd be arguing and drinking. And the third hour they'd be fighting and falling down the stairs. And the police would come and take my family to jail. And they would go in on Friday, get out on Saturday, and we would all go to church on Sunday. And that's how I perceive life to be, you know. I grew up in Brooklyn where there was a liquor store in the middle of the block and a bar in every corner. You know, I grew up in a dysfunctional neighborhood because every Friday night some family was drunk outside fighting. You know, growing up in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn was a blessing though. You know, my mom's, she worked as a nurse's aide, and the way our family was, I was the middle child. I had an older brother and a little brother. And if you're a middle child and you're in this meeting, God bless you, you know, because I believe we suffered, you know. Yeah, yeah. You know, I mopped floors, did dishes, take out garbage, watch my little brother. You know, I asked my mother, was I born to do this? You know. But I got introduced to alcohol through a lady on my block. She gave me a note and some money and sent me to the store. And I went around the corner to the bodega and I gave him the note. And he put a quart of Coke 45 in the bag. I said, quart, so you know it's a long time ago. And I came back. She poured some in the cup. She gave it to me and I liked it. So next day when I came home from school, I wrote a note and I went around the corner and got a king size can of Coke 45, you know. See, I had resentments and reservations way before I picked up a drink because I didn't fit in with my family being a middle child. You know, I can remember my brother looking at me and telling me I wasn't part of the family. And I said, why? He said, mommy bought you for 50 cents. You know, I carried that all the way to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know. But I found that back in those days, the winos used to stay on the corner and they used to sing and croon. And then one day, one of the winos, because I was hanging out with them, they poured some wine in a cup and I liked it and it burned. And I said, ooh, it burns. He said, don't worry about it. Make a man out of you. Put hair on your chest. I never got hair on my chest for 30 years, you know. But the wine was Wild Irish Rose, and I fell in love, you know. Since then, I was drinking, going to school, you know. I just didn't fit in, you know, because my name was Leon, and there was two of everybody else in my class. There was two Johns, two Sue, two Roberts, one Leon. So I didn't like my name, you know. Come to find out, I wasn't comfortable in my own skin until I got a drink, you know. I drank through school. I was a intelligent kid, and that carried, but it never worked for me. You know, alcohol, I got so bad that I started making detoxes, you know, and the first detox, I went in and they said, when you leave here, people brought the message and they said, when you leave here, don't leave with nobody, you know, make a meeting. I left with two people I don't know from detox, you know, and then I continued. I just started to drink. I didn't listen to the message. You know, I went on for about 4 or 5 more years. I made another detox and the last one, then I finally got into a rehab. But in this rehab, I did find out something, that one was too many and 1,000 was never enough. You know, I found about this allergy of alcohol, what it does to the body and what it does to the mind. You know, in this rehab, I finally got awarded a big book and I started to read the first 164 pages. You know, I also got a copy of How It Works. And every morning I got up and I read How It Works, you know, because the three pertinent ideas was definitely connected to me, you know. I was an alcoholic and I couldn't manage my own life, you know. Probably no human power could relieve this alcoholism, no matter who I pointed to. You know, I pointed at my wife. If she would leave me alone, I wouldn't drink as much. If my kids would just listen to me, I wouldn't drink as much. But none of that helped, you know. So I had to find out the third pertinent idea, that God could and would if he was sought. So I sought a higher power in these rooms. And I sought it through a sponsor, through this fellowship, you understand, and through the literature. And it began to open doors for me. You know, the old timers were the greatest. They were cruel, you know. But they had the connection for where you were going and what you would do. You know, they wasn't impressed with where you've been, you know, because I was homeless, greasy and dirty and they didn't care. You know, they always had, like they said, they had a wrench for every nut. So they definitely knew exactly how to address me. You know, I never forget one of them saying to me that, did I want to be a chairperson like Paul was? And I said, yeah. He said, see me at the end of the meeting. So I ran up to him because I wanted to be in charge of the meeting. He said, you still want to be a chairperson? I said, yes. He said, pick up the chairs. I don't know what they saw in me that I couldn't see in myself, but I was not happy with that old timer. And I picked up the chairs and I used words that I can't use on this mic, you know. And then he told me at the end, he said, now you come in tomorrow and you set up the chairs. And back in those days, as the speaker before me said, they smoked in meetings. And I tell you, I was a very intelligent person. So he said, you got to do ABCs. And I was like, what big words could A, B, and C mean? So I was like, what do you mean? He said, ashtrays, brooms, and chairs. Clean ashtrays, sweep the floor, and set up the chairs. I was an arrogant, early sober drunk, so, you know, I continued to use language that I don't want to use now, you know, but I did it, you know. And then one day he came and gave me keys and said, here, and I'm like, what's the keys for? He said, you need to make coffee. And I asked him, did I work here? You know. And he just walked on by, you know. So here I am, a useless person that's never helped anybody other than me, you know, a very self-centered person, you know, who he stopped for me from being that way. And I made coffee, I set up chairs, you know, and then one day, this grace of God is what's the reality for me within. Because God speaks through us, through people, and he makes you say things that you can't even compute how it comes out your mouth. A guy walked into the meeting and he said, I just got out of detox. Is this an AA meeting? And I said, yeah, come in, have a cup of coffee and sit down. And he's been coming ever since. This is the blessing of having old timers in your life, no matter how they talk to you. In Brooklyn, old timers said that they're suggestions, but they tell us what to do. You know. One of the things they always said when we first came around was 90 meetings in 90 days, get a home group, get a sponsor. You understand? Get a sponsor with working knowledge. And the working knowledge was being able to take you through these steps and these traditions. And these first three steps, my sponsor broke it down to me. He says, you can't. He can if you let him. But I had a problem with the word sanity. You know, because I wasn't insane. And then he asked me, what rehab were you in again? You know. But I couldn't put it together. Because I was so intelligent, you know. A day at a time, I found out what he meant. He said, in order for you to get this message of hope, you have to become teachable. And I didn't understand what teachable meant. I thought I was very intelligent. You know, I couldn't stay away from a first drink, but I knew everything else, you know. But they blessed me. I mean, these old timers were so great. He says, listening is an art. And what does art mean? You know? And when you're intelligent like me, you figure stuff out, you know? And I couldn't figure what art meant. What is it? Design? What do you draw? What does it mean? He said, always remain teachable. So I got into the steps, I got into the literature, and I began to understand what teachable means. In order for you to get this message, you have to be like the kiss sign. Keep it simple, stupid. And that's what I began to do. And then I began to learn how this great reality within turned fear into faith. And faith is the blessing that keeps me coming a day at a time. I mean, I've been through a lot of trials and tribulations, situations in my life. You know, I can remember in the rehab when they told me I was accepted. I was like, yes. And then he told me I had to go home for 4 days and call. And I was like, I can't go home because this emotional pain that I caused my family, they didn't want me on the block, you know, and, he said, well, no, go home and call. I said, well, the only way I could go home, you have to write me a note. So he wrote me a note, and I took it home to my mother. And she didn't open the gate. I asked the pastor to the gate, and she read it. And she looked at me, and she read it, and she looked at me. Then she read it one more time, and she let me in. You know? These are the blessings because I was 30-something years old taking a note to my mother. So if you're here, I'm here by the grace of God. You know, that same mother of mine who I was a turmoil in the family, you understand? She passed away June 30th, right? And I mean, December 30th. And for 26 years, I had a chance to let her have a son back. You know, then there were some other situations. I got diagnosed with prostate cancer, you know, and the fear set back in. But this higher power that we have and the love for this fellowship and the old timers who said, when you go to a medical appointment, go back for the results. I followed the directions. And to the day, my faith is outstanding. It's unshakable. You said, no matter what I go through, no matter how this disease progresses or goes into remission, you understand, as long as I have y'all, as long as I have faith, and as long as I have a higher power, my disease, who definitely wants me to be diseased, you understand, cannot win because I come into meetings and I share. I reach out to newcomers. And I talk with them. And I carry this message of hope. And I hope if anybody's in here who needs help with any medical issues, we can have a conversation. Because we got to know God's in charge. Whatever your higher power of your own understanding, you need to understand that we are only here at a happy, joyous, and free convention of 80 years is because Dr. Bob and Bill got together to talk about alcoholism. And just look at us right now. The grace of God. So the reality for me within is about faith, unshakable faith. So no matter what you go through in life, you understand, go through it in these rooms. How much time I got? Oh, wow. Go through it in these rooms, huh? Go through it in these rooms. Because what I can't do alone, we can definitely do together. You understand? This second medical disease that I have, hey, I'm living with it. I'm making meetings. I'm talking about it. I'm getting emotional with it. You know, it talks to me. You know, because the disease is looking for a place where it can target you to make you uncomfortable. So it's going to tell me the medicine ain't working. You know what I'm saying? You too tired to go to appointments. You understand? But I have a network. You understand? I have an outstanding network. You understand? And my Brooklyn outstanding network is all right here. It says special needs, but they're all right here. It's amazing. When I first came around, my sponsor told me, sit up front. And I'm like, why? Because I always sat in the back and took people's inventory. Because, you know, when you first come around, people are like the shirt, too happy, too joyous. And, you know, and you're like, where are they doing in the bathroom? So I used to sit in the back and say, that's where they're getting high at. And I would follow them in the bathroom. And it was never nothing there. You know, I know they used to look at me. Why does this guy keep going in the bathroom? You know. Because I couldn't believe that people live their lives without a drink. But with God's grace, it's possible. You know, I'm so grateful for God's mercy because I get a chance to live twice. You understand? That first person, oh my God, I can't remember growing up with anything good or bad. But in these last 27 years, wow, my family's back in my life. You know, my kids, I'm glad they old and moved out, you know. And they took the grandkids with them, you know. The blessings you get in this wonderful, wonderful fellowship. I never knew how to fall in love, but I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm never leaving. And I'm just going to do exactly what everybody else does. I'm going to reach out to a newcomer. I'm going to talk about how I feel. And I'm going to make meetings. And in closing, I just want to read something from Bill W. I'm about done, right?
Yeah, you're good.
Okay. Therefore, faith is more than our greatest gift. It's sharing with others in our greatest responsibility. So may we of AA continually seek the wisdom and the willingness by which we may well fulfill that immense trust which the giver of all perfect gifts has placed in our hands. So remember, this gift, precious, precious gift of sobriety, is basically known to work better in the present. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you very much, Leon. I was a kid. I was a middle child, too. And the shrinks I was sent to diagnosed me with middle child syndrome. It was a great excuse for behaving badly for a while. And find my place here. And this is on page 55 in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Yet we have been seeing another kind of flight, a spiritual liberation from this world. people who rose from above their problems. They said God made these things possible. And we only smiled. We had seen spiritual release, but liked to tell ourselves it wasn't true. Actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other it is there, for faith in a power greater than ourselves, and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had searched fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. We can only clear the ground a bit. If our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself, then, if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. And with that, I'd like to introduce Karen, who's come from New Brunswick. New Brunswick. I was about to say Nebraska again, because there's an NB by her name, Area 81.
Know I was going to be nervous. Hi, I'm Karen. I'm an alcoholic.
Karen.
Very, very grateful to be sober. Very thankful for AA. I'm in awe to be here today. I come from a little town that has one meeting a week, and we have probably four regular members, and we have visitors, so we have a meeting of maybe 10 or 12. So it's a little different here. When my delegate asked me if I would allow my name to stand, I said, I have to do what I have to do. I have to allow it to stand because I have to do whatever is necessary for me to keep my sobriety. So I said, yes, I would. But I didn't really know what I was getting into. And when the topic of the great reality within us came back, and that was the meeting I was going to be at, I thought, what am I getting into? Anyway, I will tell you that when I was young, I was an overachiever. I was doing everything better than anybody else, and that was the way it had to be. Second best was never good enough. And that worked really well in my life until I was 14, and I had my first drink. And I went from an honor student and who worked almost full time and went to school and looked after my brothers and sister and, you know, did everything right to a point where nothing was working very well. I was fighting at home. My schoolwork went down to nothing. And life was quite miserable. I went from a happy person to a very unhappy person and had no idea that alcohol was the problem. So when I turned 18, I needed to get away, and I ran away from home and got married. Yeah, that worked. I moved to the States, and I didn't have an opportunity to drink much for a few years because my husband got sick, and I had the two small children, and I had no means to drink. And I went through that process, but when my husband passed away, I looked for some kind of freedom, some kind of escape, something that was going to give me some fun in my life. And of course, the first thing I wanted to do was to go and have a drink. My drinking had been out of control, and even though I had not had anything to drink for probably 3 years, I think the disease of alcoholism kept progressing because as soon as I started to drink again, I was in trouble. I only drank on the weekends, but I was drinking a lot. And it became a little longer weekend, you know, Thursday, Monday, you know, and so on. And the weekends were longer. and the time not drinking was shorter. And I started to go into blackouts, and I started to get into trouble, and I thought, I know what to do. I'll remarry. That'll fix it all. Well, then things will be normal. And I have to tell you that marriage doesn't cure alcoholism. I remarried, and the problem got worse, of course. And for the next several years, I went from caring a little bit about things to caring about nothing at all. My only concern was to have something to drink, how I was going to get it, how I was going to get over it. And that became my life. I just didn't care about anything. In 1973, I had an opportunity to drive to Ontario to see my father receive a 20-year medallion in AA, which I thought was pretty nice that he could do that. Interestingly enough, my brother was a speaker. And as I was listening to them, my brother said, I couldn't guarantee what was going to happen after I took the first drink. And I listened to that and I said, what are you talking about? That's normal. Who knows what's going to happen after you take the first drink? My God, you know? Like, really? I never went out to get drunk. It just happened, you know? And every once in a while, I could come home semi-sober. No problems. No trouble. Ha-ha. See, I can do that. But when he told me that, I said, you're calling me an alcoholic. And he said, no. He said, I'm telling you that that's the way it is with me. But if the shoe fits. Oh. Well, I wasn't sure what resentments were, but I had one then. For the next 2.5 years, I worked very hard at drinking and not getting drunk. And it didn't work very well. I was trying to prove to my brother that I wasn't an alcoholic, I guess. I finally decided that I was going to not drink for a little while. So I stopped drinking for 2 weeks. And I think my higher power has a great sense of humor, because during those 2 weeks, I was awarded a trip to go to the Canary Islands, all expenses paid, and open bar. What self-respecting alcoholic would go there and drink pop? Anyway, I got all decked out, my very best, and I got on the plane, and the lady had a drink. And then the lady disappeared. And my drinking was such that I hardly remember. I didn't even know where the Canary Islands were to start with. Anyway. And I might as well have stayed in the tavern, because I don't remember much about it. Anyway, it was a pretty disastrous trip. And that was the beginning of the end. And I came to realize that I had a problem with alcohol. And on March the 15th, 1976, I woke up after a 4 or 5 day drinking spree that I don't remember much about, and I realized that I had to do something about my alcoholism. A member came and talked to me, and I went to my first meeting. And members at that meeting said to me, you never have to live that way again. Can you imagine? I never have to live that way again. Wow. That gave me such hope. And then they said, do you think you can stay sober for 24 hours? And I said, sure. If I want to get high, I'll just smoke pot. Well, in those days, the older members were quite vocal. And they said, if you want to stay sober, you cannot substitute the alcohol with anything else. You must stay clean and sober so that your mind will clear and you'll be able to understand this program. What I didn't understand was that I had to not drink in order to get the program to learn how to live sober. I thought just not drinking was all I had to do. And I started to go to meetings, and I looked at the steps, and I looked at the traditions, and I heard people talking, and they were talking about God and about changing, and I said, I don't need to change. I just drank too much. There's nothing wrong with me. And a member said, if you can't do the fourth step, I'll help you. You're not perfect yet. Anyway, they were very good to allow me to grow at the rate that I needed to grow. I said, I have no intention of getting involved in this God thing. I can stay sober. I can do this thing. And I thought it was a matter of willpower. And I was miserable. And people would say, how are you? And I'd say, fine. And then I thought to myself, no, you're not fine, Karen. They'd say, how are you? Rotten, thank you. And I continued. And they said, get a sponsor. So I did. And each time I went to visit my sponsor, I told him how miserable I was and how rotten life was and how poor me. Things were horrible. And he said, can you think of anything that you could be grateful for? And I said, like what? He said, you're not drinking. I said, yeah, but, you know, really, listen to me. And I tried to tell him how rotten things were. And this man was pouring a cup of tea for me, and he had to put his finger in the top of the cup so that the water wouldn't pour over the top, because my sponsor was blind. And my sponsor was trying to teach me how to see. And I couldn't see because I was so blinded by this terrible disease of alcoholism that I couldn't see just how very blessed I was. I still was able to get up in the morning, walk, talk, hear, see. My children had shown me how to love. I was leaving for a meeting one night, and my two boys gave me a hug. And that was the first time in my life that we had ever hugged. I didn't know anything about that. They taught me that. I decided I was going to go and visit my parents. And I was thinking the way I thought when I was 14 and I had gone away from home for a few weeks. How do I greet my parents? I didn't know how. Did I shake hands with them? Did I just walk in and say hello? I didn't know. And I thought, because of the gift that my children had given me, I said, I'm going to give them a hug. And I went to see my parents and I hugged them. And it was the first time in my life that we had hugged. Imagine the gift. And I hugged my brothers and my sister, and they hugged back. We became quite a hugging family after that. Somebody had to start it. I had no idea that there was more to sobriety than not drinking. But having to try and find a higher power was beyond me. When I was drinking, I decided that if I didn't ask God for anything, then God wouldn't have to ask me for anything. We could go our separate ways. In my insanity, I thought that this was a thing I should do. My sponsor suggested that I ask God's help. And the kind of prayers that I had, if I ever prayed at all, were to tell the higher power to do my will. I wanted things my way. I wanted them now. And quite often that didn't work. So I didn't think God was listening to me. And I said, no, I'm not going to get into that stuff. And he said, really? He said, throw your shoes under the bed, get down on your knees and get your shoes, and just say thank you for this day. And I couldn't bring myself to do it either. And one day, when I was so miserable that I said, if this is sobriety, somebody take it and shove it, because it's not for me.
And I was sitting in a meeting, and I heard how it works for the 100th time, maybe. And suddenly, it was like a light bulb moment, but it was the whole chandelier, because I read those three pertinent ideas. And the third pertinent idea said, God could and would if he were sought. I thought, my God, that's it. That's it. That's the program. It was the most remarkable realization for me. And I did go home very embarrassed. I put my shoes under the bed and I got down on my knees in the morning and I said, thank you, whatever concept of higher power that I didn't know existed. And I got up off my knees and I said, okay, I did whatever I had to do to stay sober. I got on my knees, but I don't know if I'll ever do it again. However, the interesting thing was that every time I asked God to help me through a situation, things seemed to be better. And it started to dawn on me that this was what the program was all about. I had that terrible moment of despair when I couldn't drink and I had to give up alcohol. Now I came to the point where I had to give up this need to control, this need to have things my way. I had to turn my will over to God. And that's a hard thing for an alcoholic to do. And I struggled with it. And I tried. And then things wouldn't work out the way I wanted to, and I'd shake my fist at my higher power. And I'd say, that's not the way it should be. And I eventually came to a point where I realized that I had to accept the things I couldn't change. And I used to say, you know, that serenity prayer is pretty good, if you could only figure out the wisdom to know the difference. I didn't know what I could change and what I couldn't. I thought I could change anybody and everything. I thought I had some kind of control over people, places, and things. And I finally came to understand that what somebody else did was none of my business. Just as I wouldn't allow other people to push me into doing what they wanted me to, I didn't have the right to do that to anyone else either. The lessons that I learned through sobriety were absolutely remarkable. I came to know a higher power. I came to find a connection with a higher power. I call that higher power today my creator. And I came to understand what gratitude was. It's one of the things that I guess I try to talk about whenever I have an opportunity, especially to newcomers. Say, put a gratitude list together. Try to see what is good in your life today. Because my world was so negative. You know, I was looking at everything from such a negative point of view. And when I started to find things to be grateful for, I started to get away from that negative thinking. And I started to realize that I was not drinking because things were better when I wasn't drinking. Imagine. I started to like not drinking. Wow, what a gift. It's been quite a journey. I've had a lot of issues through sobriety, with family, with hard times. But learning to accept them has allowed me to be free of alcohol. Life is hard sometimes. You know? And when I would say, why me, when something very, very difficult would happen, my sponsor would say, why would you be exempt just because you're alcoholic? That's life. You know, accepting life on life's terms. and asking God for help to get through these things. You know, when the husband that I found in AA got sick with cancer, I didn't have to drink. I was able to get through that very, very difficult experience with the strength and courage that AA members gave me. I'm able to find a peace and serenity in my life, regardless of what goes on around. You know, when you have children, and you're the children of an alcoholic, there's going to be issues in your home and your family as well. You know, why would my children not be alcoholic? Of course, the chances are they probably will be. My grandchildren. You know, but today, I can pray that the Creator will watch over them and allow them to have the journey that I've been able to have. It is a wonderful journey. When I used to look at those promises, I'd say, are you serious? Who in their right mind would think that that could happen to us? And slowly, the promises started to work in my life. And I gained that freedom. And it says, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. I am amazed. I don't know if I'm halfway through or not. Probably a little bit more. Might have taken me a little longer. You know, I'm alcoholic. It took me a little longer. Anyway, I am amazed because I couldn't have imagined the life that sobriety gave me. It allowed me to have my hopes, my dreams, my ambitions back. It allowed me to follow a path of service. It allowed me to follow a path where I could become a productive member of society. You know, today, I'm able to help other people. I'm able to get outside of myself and my ego and to look for what I can do for someone else. I am so very thankful today to have found this program. I know a lot had to do with my mother's prayers, and it had to do with my father's example and my brother's example. I am blessed. I am so blessed to be here. 80 years of sobriety. I am so thankful that AA was in existence when my father needed to find a way to stay sober. And he could pass that on to the next generation. And perhaps I'll have an opportunity to pass that on to my children or grandchildren. I have that gift that I can pass on. The reality in my life today is that I have a higher power that guides my life. And I am so grateful. Thank you.